Imagine for a second that you're holding a passport that gives you like the ultimate untouchable VIP status in the world.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking complete immunity from local law enforcement,
yeah,
top-tier social standing, massive economic benefits, the works.
Right, the dream.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, imagine you are falsely accused of a crime in a bustling city. The authorities drag you into the public square, they strip you down, and proceed to brutally beat you with rods before throwing you into this lightless freezing dungeon.
Ouch.
And the entire time, you have that VIP passport in your pocket.
Wait, really?
Yeah. One word from you and the beating stops. The magistrates would be absolutely terrified. But you choose to stay silent. You take the beating, and you sit in the dark. Why in the world would anyone do that?
I mean, it sounds completely irrational, right? Until you realize that the person taking the beating is playing a much longer, much deeper game. They are, they're operating under a totally different set of rules.
Welcome to today's Deep Dive. We are so glad you're here with us because today we are unpacking a 2,000-year-old letter that just completely dismantles our modern ideas of citizenship, community, and, you know, even how we view our own personal hardships.
Yeah, it really does.
We're going to be looking closely at the book of Philippians, specifically chapter 1, verses 27 through 30. And to understand the magnitude of what's happening in this text, we have to recognize that this isn't just an ancient religious document. It is a radical political and social manifesto.
It truly is a paradigm-shifting text. I mean, when you read it closely and understand the historical context it was written in, it forces you to completely reevaluate where your true home actually is.
Right.
And what you are willing to endure for it.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because before we pull out the magnifying glass and look at those specific verses, we need to zoom out.
Yeah, definitely.
You can't just pluck a verse out of an ancient letter and expect to understand it in isolation. We have to look at the blueprint of the letter itself.
That's a crucial first step. We have to remember that the author, the Apostle Paul, he didn't write with chapter and verse numbers.
Right. Those came way later.
Exactly. Those were added centuries later. So Philippians chapter 1, verse 27, all the way through chapter 4, verse 3, it actually forms a single coherent literary unit. It's the main body of the letter.
Okay.
And the way we know this is through the author's use of an envelope structure. He brackets this massive section with parallel ideas.
So he's opening and closing the thought with the exact same concepts.
Yes. He mentions citizenship at the very beginning of the section and then again at the very end.
Oh, wow.
He talks about standing firm at the beginning and the end. He explicitly mentions the destruction of opponents, and he even uses the exact same Greek word family for encouragement as the book ends. In literary terms, this is called an inclusio.
I was actually reading up on ancient literary structures, and it makes total sense why they did this, you know?
Yeah.
Today, if we want to emphasize something in a document, we just bold it or highlight it or change the font size.
Right, just make it bigger.
Exactly. But in an oral culture, where texts were read aloud to a room full of people, they had to use structural symmetry to say, hey, pay attention to this.
Yeah, you had to hear the structure.
And within this big envelope, there's this fascinating ancient structure at play called a chiasm.
Oh, yeah. The chiasm is where the real brilliance of the text shines. A chiastic structure is essentially a literary bullseye.
A bullseye. I like that.
Yeah. You have matching parallel ideas on the outside. And as you read or listen forward, the ideas step inward, mirroring each other and pointing you toward the very center. So the structure goes A, B, C, and then works backwards B, A.
So it's actively funneling the listener's attention inward.
Exactly. Yeah. And that center point, the C, is the foundational truth of the whole argument. Everything else in the letter revolves around it.
Okay, so what's the C in this letter?
In this main body of Philippians, the absolute center is the famous Christ hymn found in chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. It's the ultimate picture of Christ stepping down from heaven, taking the form of a servant, suffering, and then being exalted.
I was trying to visualize how this actually works in practice. And I keep thinking about it like dropping a heavy rock into a completely still pot of water.
Oh, that's a good visual.
Right. The rock itself is that Christ in chapter 2. When that heavy rock hits the dead center of the water, you get a massive splash. But immediately, these ripples start traveling outward, affecting every single inch of the water in that pot.
That is the perfect way to look at it. The passage we are diving into today, verses 27 through 30 of chapter 1, represents the very first major ripples from that central splash.
Gotcha.
Everything Paul commands the Philippians to do in these verses is entirely downstream from who Christ is and what Christ has done.
And it's a pretty jarring shift in the letter, too.
Mm-hmm.
Up until verse 27, Paul has basically just been giving status updates. Like, here are my travel plans, here's how I'm doing in prison.
Yeah, it reads like a first century newsletter.
Exactly. But here's where it gets really interesting. Right here in verse 27, the tone flips. He drops his very first actual command.
He demands an action. Most English translations will soften this a bit, actually.
Really? How so?
Well, they'll say something like, let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel. But if we look at the literal Greek root word Paul chooses to use here, it is politema.
Politema. Which immediately brings to mind politics, or like a metropolis.
Exactly, because it is rooted in the idea of the city-state. Paul isn't using general spiritualized language here. He isn't just saying, hey, be a good moral person.
Right.
He is explicitly utilizing a political verb. He is commanding this early church live as a citizen.
But wait, a citizen of where?
If
Philippi, because yeah. Context is everything here. Philippi wasn't just some random town on the map, right?
No, not at all.
It was a Roman colony. From what I understand about the history, living in Philippi as an official Roman citizen came with some unbelievable perks. We are talking about the Isius Italicum, the Italian Rite.
Oh, it was highly coveted. I mean, if you had Roman citizenship in Philippi, you were exempt from certain crippling taxes. You could buy and sell property under Roman law, which afforded you massive economic protection.
Wow.
You had a direct line of appeal to the emperor, and you were completely immune from the most degrading forms of physical punishment.
So you were basically royalty.
You were functionally the ancient world's aristocracy, yeah.
So you had a blue chip passport. But here's the catch. Only a minority of the actual population of Philippi held that official status. And the vast majority of people sitting in this early church, slaves, tradespeople, the lower classes, they definitely didn't have it.
They were completely on the outside looking in. So when Paul tells this mixed room of people to live as citizens, he is doing something incredibly subversive.
Because he's not talking about Rome.
Exactly. He is telling them to live as citizens of God's kingdom, essentially bypassing the social hierarchy of Rome entirely.
Which brings us back to that hook I mentioned at the very beginning of the deep dive, the story of Paul getting beaten. Because this wasn't just some theoretical concept for him. If you look at the backstory of how this Philippian church was founded, back in Acts chapter 16, Paul and Silas are in Philippi. They disrupt the local economy by freeing an enslaved girl.
Yeah.
And the city magistrates just lose their minds.
They absolutely panic.
Yeah. They have Paul and Silas dragged into the marketplace, stripped of their clothing, and beaten with rods by the local authorities. And a Roman beating with rods was designed to humiliate and break a person physically.
It was brutal, bloody, public trauma. And they were then thrown into the inner prison and locked in stocks.
But Paul actually was a Roman citizen. He was born with that status. It was highly illegal to strip and beat a Roman citizen without a proper trial.
Highly illegal.
He had the ultimate trump card sitting right in his back pocket. If he just yells out, Civis Romanus sum, I am a Roman citizen, the lictors drop their rods immediately. The penalty for mistreating a Roman citizen could mean the magistrates themselves losing their positions, or even worse. So why on earth didn't Paul play his Roman citizen trump card before he was beaten?
It comes down to solidarity, really, and demonstrating true allegiance. Think about the makeup of the church he was trying to build there.
Right.
If Paul uses his elite legal status to escape hardship, he immediately elevates himself above the non-citizens in his congregation. How could he possibly be an example of enduring faith to a room full of people who don't have a trump card to play when the empire turns on them?
Oh, wow. He intentionally absorbs the trauma.
Yes.
He takes the beating so he can look his congregation in the eye, the slaves, the poor, the marginalized, and say, my passport says heaven, not Rome, and yours does too. We are in this together.
His actions proved that his ultimate loyalty wasn't to the empire that could protect him, but to the heavenly kingdom that he represented. As great as Roman citizenship was, he considered it entirely secondary.
Okay, so this brings it right to the doorstep of the listener. If you are listening to this right now, and you claim to be a citizen of this heavenly kingdom, but you are physically walking around in a fallen, complicated, thoroughly human world, what are the actual laws of the land? How do you live a life worthy of this heavenly passport?
Well, Paul provides the framework for that right alongside the command. The gospel itself functions as the constitution of God's kingdom.
The constitution?
Yeah, it is the governing document. Yes, it's an announcement of the good news of what Christ has done, but it also serves as the absolute measuring stick against which we are supposed to evaluate our everyday lives.
I really resonate with that idea of a constitution, but You know, human nature makes this complicated.
Of course it does.
Think about your own life for a second. We have a massive, undeniable tendency to only obey the rules when the authorities are physically in the room watching us.
So true.
It makes me think of driving on the highway. The speed limit is clearly posted at 60 miles an hour. But you're cruising at 75, maybe 80, because the road is open and the weather is good. You feel completely fine about it. Until you come around the bend and see a police cruiser sitting in the median, what happens? You instinctively slam on the brakes.
Right. Your behavior snaps into alignment with the law solely because the authority figure is suddenly present and visible.
Exactly. Or think about how office dynamics change when the boss goes on a two-week vacation. Standards slip, long lunches happen, out of sight, out of mind.
Oh, absolutely.
But Paul is actively anticipating this exact human flaw. He tells the Philippians, whether I come and see you or am absent, I want to hear that you are standing firm. He is telling them, this gospel constitution applies whether I am rotting in a prison cell hundreds of miles away or standing right in front of you.
And notice the specific phrasing he uses for how they are supposed to do this. He says they must be standing firm in one spirit.
In one spirit.
Right. Often we read that as a lowercase s, as in a unified human attitude or team spirit. But the context strongly suggests Paul is referring to the Holy Spirit.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he is stressing that it is the Spirit of God who actually enables a person to stand firm. You cannot simply grit your teeth and follow a perfect heavenly constitution on your own willpower.
I watch a lot of football, and that phrase, standing firm, immediately triggers an image for me. The original Greek word carries this heavy, militaristic idea of holding your ground against a severe assault.
Right.
It's an American football offensive line. You've got these five massive guys, and their entire job, their only objective, is to link together, dig their cleats into the turf, hold the line, and protect the quarterback from a massive onslaught of defenders.
That's a great comparison.
And here's the reality of the offensive line. You absolutely cannot stand firm if you are acting alone. If one single guy on that line decides to do his own thing or drops his block, the defense pours through and the whole play collapses.
The individual's success is entirely dependent on the collective. And Paul makes that exact pivot in his argument next. He moves from the concept of individual obedience to the absolute necessity of the corporate body.
Okay.
He tells them they need to be striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. That phrase implies a concerted, synchronized effort. It is a shared struggle in the trenches.
Which feels like a direct attack on how so many of us operate today.
Oh, completely.
In the modern West, we completely idolize the rugged individual. We celebrate the self-made person, the lone wolf, the maverick. And sadly, you see that bleed right into how people view their spirituality.
You really do.
It's so incredibly common to hear someone treat their faith as a completely solo project. They say, you know, it's just me and my Bible. I can worship God in the woods. I don't need organized religion, and I certainly don't need a church. They actively skip the messy, exhausting reality of community.
It's a comfortable mindset, sure, but it completely contradicts the blueprint of heavenly citizenship Paul is laying out. You cannot form an offensive line by yourself in the woods. God saves individuals, certainly, but he immediately and purposefully places them into a collective body.
I heard a story recently about a seminary pastor who was preaching a long series on the book of Hebrews. Now, Hebrews is an intense book all about enduring through persecution, holding fast, and persevering through incredibly tough times. And the pastor titled his entire sermon series, Help Me Get to Heaven.
Wow. That is a profoundly honest title.
It really stuck with me. Help Me Get to Heaven. Because it strips away all the posturing and acknowledges that perseverance in faith is not a solo endeavor. It's a rescue mission and it's a corporate project.
When you face intense opposition or when you are just worn down by the mundane trials of life, your own willpower will fail.
It always does.
You desperately need other people standing shoulder to shoulder with you to remind you of the truth. You need someone else to remind you of who God is when your own vision gets cloudy. Community is the forge where this kingdom citizenship is actually tested and proven.
Even though dealing with other people can be exhausting, let's be honest, community is messy because people are complicated, offensive, and needy.
Very true.
But if standing shoulder to shoulder in this offensive line implies there's something on the other side of the ball trying to knock you down, what exactly is the fire we are facing?
Well, Paul says it's the opposition itself. Which brings us to the final and honestly the most shocking takeaway from this entire passage.
Okay, lay it on me.
Yes, we have to look closely at verse 29. Paul writes to this church that God has graciously granted two specific gifts to his people. Now, when we hear the phrase graciously granted, we naturally think of unmerited favor. We think of something wonderful given out of pure love.
Sure.
And the first gift Paul lists makes perfect sense: faith. He has granted you the ability to believe in Christ.
And if you were sitting in that first century congregation, you would nod and say, great, we love the gift of faith. Sign me up. I'll take two.
Exactly. But then Paul drops an absolute plot twist. He reveals the second graciously granted gift. He says you have been granted not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake.
Suffering, categorized as a graciously granted gift.
Yes.
I have to admit, as a modern reader, that is deeply jarring. It feels entirely counterintuitive. It's like waking up on Christmas morning as a kid. You see this beautiful box under the tree with your name on it. Hmm? You tear it open, and it's the exact toy you asked for that's the gift of faith. Pure joy.
Right.
But then your parents hand you a second box. You open it, and it's this incredibly itchy, hideous, oversized wool sweater that you would never wear in a million years.
Right.
But because it's a gift, you have to paste on a fake smile, hold it up, and say, oh, wow, thank you so much. How in the world can we possibly classify suffering as a gift?
It's the ultimate question of the text, and there is a deeply insightful psychological parallel we can look at to help us understand the mechanism of what suffering actually does to the human brain.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Think about patients who receive a terminal medical diagnosis. Studies have shown that when a person is told they have a very limited time left, say, 6 months to live, they suddenly experience a razor-sharp mental focus.
Because the timeline has shrunk.
Exactly. When you have unlimited time and comfort, you care about everything. But when you are thrust into the ultimate crisis, all the trivial distractions of life immediately burn away. You become hyper-focused on what truly, eternally matters.
You stop caring about the office politics, or the fact that someone cut you off in traffic, or what color to paint the guest bathroom. You suddenly start focusing entirely on making things right with your family, your legacy, the state of your soul.
It's an enforced prioritization. But what's truly fascinating is that researchers have noted a specific phenomenon when that same patient goes into remission.
Really? What happens?
If a miracle happens and the cancer recedes and the crisis is suddenly removed, that intense, beautiful clarity often fades over time. As the years go by and comfort returns, they slowly revert back to their old ways, getting bogged down and stressed out by the exact same trivial distractions they had previously abandoned.
That is incredibly sobering to think about. The suffering, the crisis itself, acted as a lens that provided ultimate clarity.
That is precisely why Paul refers to it as a gift. Suffering is not a gift because the pain itself is good. Let's be clear, the pain is still terrible, heartbreaking, and difficult.
Right.
It's a gift because it forcibly strips away the non-essentials. It serves as a diagnostic tool that reveals what we truly treasure.
If your hope and your identity are anchored in earthly comforts, your bank account, your physical health, your reputation suffering will expose that instantly because those things can be taken away.
Exactly.
But if your true citizenship is in heaven, suffering acts as the lens that focuses your eyes precisely on that unbreakable reality.
And we must remember, Paul isn't speaking in abstract theological theories here. He is writing this letter from a Roman prison. He is speaking from his own lived experience of beatings, shipwrecks, and imprisonments.
Yeah, he's living it.
He is telling the Philippians, I am engaged in this conflict, you see it in my life, and now you are experiencing it too. We are identified with Christ through our faith, but we are also intimately identified with him through our shared suffering.
So we've covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with the literary architecture of ancient letters and rocks dropping in pots. We moved through Roman legal loopholes and public beatings. We talked about offensive linemen and the myth of the lone wolf Christian. And we ended on the psychology of terminal diagnoses and itchy Christmas sweaters.
We really did.
But the through line connecting all of this is remarkably clear.
It is. It's a singular call to recognize where your tree citizenship lies and to let that reality dictate your behavior, whether you are being watched or not. It's a challenge to lean into the messy, exhausting, vital reality of human community so we can literally help each other get to heaven.
Yeah.
And it is a radical reframing of how we view our hardships, not as arbitrary punishments from an angry God, but as clarifying, priority-shifting gifts.
This first century text is reaching across two millennia to directly challenge you, the listener, to evaluate your allegiances today.
Yeah.
It's demanding that we stop trying to live our spiritual lives in a comfortable, isolated vacuum.
Absolutely.
Which brings me to a final thought I want to leave you with today. We talked earlier about that VIP passport. and how your citizenship changes the way you interact with the hostile world around you. We also just explored how a terminal diagnosis, a sudden intense introduction of suffering, sharpens our focus on what is truly eternal, and how remission often dulls that focus.
Right.
So as you go about your day, here is something for you to mull over. If suffering functions as a powerful lens that strips away the non-essentials and clarifies what truly matters, how might our everyday comforts and our modern avoidance of opposition actually be dulling our spiritual senses? Could our highly comfortable, fiercely independent lives actually be making us worse citizens of this kingdom?
That's a profound question.
It's a heavy question, but it's one worth sitting with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep looking out for each other, and we'll see you next time.